we're speaking just after the Afghan elections. One gets the feeling that the results were a cook in advance, but much of the promised or expected violence didn't materialize. What does it say about the state of the Taliban?
Well, the Taliban is divided largely into two factions. A minority faction led by Mullah Omar supports Osama bin Laden and are fighting some way or the other. The majority faction, which was always under the control of Pakistani military intelligence, is now busy negotiating with Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. viceroy in Afghanistan. This is not reported in the American press, I think, at all. But in the Pakistani press, it's often discussed that secret negotiations between Khalilzad and Karzai and the Taliban have been taking place to provide Karzai with some sort of a base in that country. So ironically, this war, which was supposedly launched to destroy the Taliban, with the foreign occupation, they're ending up negotiating with the Taliban again. The elections were fraudulent from beginning to end. Everyone knows that. Women in many areas were not allowed to vote by their husbands in most of the zones controlled by the warlords and in parts of Kabul. And essentially the whole thing, you know, smells. And even the United Nations observers present have said that there were grave irregularities. The opposition leaders all, or the opposition candidates, initially said they wouldn't accept the result. And then I think Zalmay Khalilzad promised them more money and a free range and a free hand in producing heroin, which they're busy doing since the collapse. And so they've seemed to have succumbed temporarily. But the notion that this is a serious election is, of course, regarded there and elsewhere as a joke. The main aim is to provide a cloak of legitimacy for Karzai, and in that it will fail.
And does Karzai's government have any power? Do they control any of the society of any of the territory, or are they just a figurehead?
Karzai is a total figurehead. All the key decisions in Afghanistan are taken by Khalilzad, the direct representative of the Bush administration in that country. When deals have to be cut, no one takes Karzai seriously. The Northern Alliance say we'd rather talk to the organ grinder than the monkey and go straight to Khalilzad. And Khalilzad is often seen commuting daily from the American embassy to the presidential palace, where he meets people and cuts the deals. So Karzai has basically nil real support in that country. And were foreign troops to be withdrawn, they'd have to take him with them.
But how far has this American influence spread, or is the country really govern itself?
Well, it doesn't govern itself. You have American control of Kabul during the day, of Kandahar during the day. Elsewhere, the country is controlled by the old warlords. Dostum in his region, the Iranians or their surrogates in Herat, and all the accounts that come out of Afghanistan say that the country now has been completely atomized, and it's going to take a very long time before a central government will be accepted. And the United States does not want to fight a war with the warlords. From their point of view, it's not so stupid. Why should we lose more people? They cut deals with them instead, so they, you know, give them a free hand on things that matter to them. And the country is chaotic. It's basically a coalition of warlords who runs the bulk of the country, and Karzai and Khalilzad run Kabul.
And if you listen to John Kerry, this is because of the Bush administration's incompetence in managing the war in its aftermath. Do you agree with that? Could it have been done differently, or is the whole task impossible?
I think if you make wars and occupy countries in times of neoliberalism, when a neoliberal order prevails globally, it becomes very difficult, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq, to strengthen the state in these countries, give pots of money to reconstruct the social infrastructure, to build a national health service, an education system which is funded by the state. They cannot do it. In Iraq, they're trying to do it privately, and it isn't working. In Afghanistan, which is shocking given what they promised, they haven't done it at at all. So even people who were initially sympathetic to them and delighted that the Taliban had been overthrown are now complaining and moaning, saying all they've done is to make the situation worse. The women's groups are saying that the number of rapes in Afghanistan have increased tenfold since the toppling of the Taliban, that law and order doesn't exist in that country, that the women are still being oppressed. All this is going on because basically there's no interest for the United States to do it. And it's something which is making even very pro-American people in Pakistan understand that nothing much is going to happen. They spend a lot of money on weaponry, on security, but very little on building the country.
Though there are some theories of the war that it was all about the gas pipeline. You would think that it would be very dangerous to run a gas pipeline across a country that is so politically unstable. What do you think of the gas pipeline theory, and what's its fate in the present?
To be honest, I was never convinced by that. I mean, there's no doubt that Unocal was negotiating various deals with the Taliban, but Unocal understood, as sort of tough-minded businessman, that in order to have a pipeline through the country, you needed a strong central government, which is why they were dealing with the Taliban. As Mike Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 showed, these bearded figures suddenly arriving at Unocal headquarters in Houston and people saying, what the hell's going on? But that's who they were negotiating with because they understood. And oil companies understand this much, much better than ideologues, that in order to have an oil pipeline through a country, you need a stable central government. That doesn't exist in Afghanistan. So I think Unocal would be crazy, or any other oil company would be crazy, trying to run a pipeline through Afghanistan. No, I've always disagreed with the notion. It's too simplistic and instrumentalist that the United States invaded Afghanistan to secure a pipeline. I don't believe that. I think it's always, a war of revenge to punish a country which had allowed sanctuary, given sanctuary to Osama bin Laden. That was the aim of the exercise, and Bush himself said we want to destroy al-Qaeda. He claimed in the debate with Kerry that we've destroyed 75% of them. Well, if you've destroyed 75% of them, then it's a big victory for you. What is the war against terror if you've destroyed the bulk of your enemy? But they haven't done that, actually. Instead, they're trying to run a country which, as the British discovered before them, is virtually impossible to run.
Now, a bit about Afghanistan's neighbor, your ancestral home, Pakistan. How are things there? Is Musharraf firmly in control, or is he wobbly?
Musharraf seems to be firmly in control. And to understand that, you have to understand the character of the Pakistan army, that this is not a Middle Eastern army like the Egyptian, Iraqi, Syrian armies in the 50s and 60s. These armies became very radical because a whole layer of the petty bourgeoisie, radical urban petty bourgeoisie, joined the army and they became officers. In Pakistan, the hierarchical character of the army, top command from the top, has never been broken. We have never had majors and colonels seizing power in that country. The generals have maintained firm control. So there is a sort of trade union solidarity amongst the generals, even if they loathe each other, to make sure that the structure of the army isn't broken. A few months ago, some majors were arrested on the grounds that they were plotting against Musharraf, but whether they were plotting or whether they were talking at home about Musharraf's total dependence on the United States, no one knows what the plot was. But they were arrested. But by and large, I would say Musharraf is quite secure, and he is now beginning to do what Hosni Mubarak, the Egyptian leader, did in Egypt, which is to use a lot of the money which the United States is pouring into the country to simply buy off the army. A rank-and-file soldier is offered a plot of land to build a house in a city. And lots of poor people say, God, we should join the army. You know, how could, if you get a tiny bit of land on which to build something, this is great, this is tremendous. So there's a combination of money and coercion being used to keep the army under control. So my feeling is that as far as the army is concerned, Musharraf is safe for the moment. As far
there
as
were those assassination attempts, yeah, that had the feel of an inside job, though.
They were. They were, and the last set of assassination attempts were incredibly serious. And we now know that it was people from within his own intelligence services who supplied that information. They've been purged. There's been a very brutal purge of people inside close to him because they tortured the guys they arrested and they squealed. So names were named. Most of these people have been locked up and disappeared without any trace. So he has been effective. But there's no doubt in my mind that if, let's say, he were to find Osama bin Laden and hand him over to George W. as an election present or an inauguration present if he wins, he wouldn't last long, because that is something which would create havoc inside even those sections of the army who are not religious but would feel that this is one step too far. And he knows that. So they're keeping quiet about where he is. So obviously he could be bumped off, you know, that any leader can be. But that depends a lot on whether the Islamists in Pakistan, A, are up to it, B, want to at a certain stage.
What is the state of the Islamists in Pakistan? They won a provincial election a while back, right?
They won two. They won an election in the Northwest Frontier Province, where they've started. I mean, you know, they're incapable of doing anything useful socially. So the first things they do are all the advertising billboards which show women, actresses in movies, without the veil. Basically, they've been sending around little teams of bearded volunteers to go and paint these women out. Now, the women, you know, women in that, feminists in Pakistan, are complaining bitterly. And the mullahs are replying, well, you know, this is unacceptable to us, but it's on that level. They haven't so far managed to impose the Sharia, Islamic laws, in that province. And I think Musharraf has warned them that if they try and do that, he would just sack them and dismiss the government. So it's a weird situation. And then they're falling out with each other, because they're the old Islamists, the Party of Islam people, the Jamaat-e-Islami, who were used to be funded by the Saudis and the United States, and they are quite firm in their beliefs. Then there's Maulana Fazlur Rahman, who leads a party which is more radical and had an anti-imperialist past. And he basically is into making money. He was doing deals with politicians for diesel stations and petrol stations. And his nickname in the country is Maulana Diesel, because he is a great operator. And he travels to India. I mean, he's essentially said to the army, I'm prepared to do a deal with you. So there's, on the level of the official Islamists, there's no serious threat to the army. The threat comes from these armed groups which they created themselves, which they're now trying to disentangle themselves from. And these groups are sort of vying revenge. That's their problem. It's a similar situation as, you know, the United States used Osama and these people and trained and armed them to fight in Afghanistan. And then when they dumped them, the guys turned on them. And in a small way, the same thing is happening to the Pakistan army in Pakistan itself.
Now, there's a lot of anxiety among Kerry supporters here that Pakistan would magically deliver up Osama a week before the election. You sound like you don't put much faith in that.
Well, it's difficult to say, but I was in Pakistan for a month not so long ago. And all the people I talked to tended to say that this was, you know, fantasy. And when I asked some quite senior people, but does anyone in the country know where Osama is? And here the general opinion was someone in the intelligence networks must know where he is, because they're the people who were in touch with him for many, many years. And people also said to me, if he is in the regions between Afghanistan and Pakistan, it's inconceivable that someone doesn't know. But from that, to be totally sure that they do know, or they can take him out, or that he could be delivered to Bush, it's a long shot. They might try and find someone else high up in the hierarchy, but that won't have the same effect.
Let's take a little detour. Samantha Power was on 60 Minutes the other night, emoting in that way she does about Darfur, and talking about the need to intervene, to do something. First of all, what do you make of that kind of call for humanitarian intervention? And a lot of people look at it as just a kind of liberal imperialism. But then secondly, how do we respond to crises like Darfur?
Well, I think humanitarian intervention, the English historian Eric Hobsbawm described this as the imperialism of human rights, i.e. using the human rights stack to fulfill imperial aims. So I think we should draw, I mean, the left shouldn't take any of that seriously, but there is a problem. When you have a situation like the situation in Darfur, should there be an intervention? And in my opinion, the answer is yes. The question is, who should carry out this intervention? My opinion, a lot of pressure should be put on the Sudanese government by the South Africans, by regional powers, to say that, look, you have to do something. We're quite prepared to come and help you do it with your support. But if you don't allow us that, if you don't give us that support, we will have to do it because too many people are being killed. I think if it is done regionally without big powers being involved, it gives the intervention a totally different character and also means that it's a temporary intervention, that you're not going to intervene and then end up with big military bases, as the United States did in Bosnia and Kosovo, giant military bases to expand NATO. When Rwanda, they didn't intervene at all because it wasn't strategically important. So I think we need, the left should argue for regional organizations in Africa or Latin America to intervene where a genuine crisis is taking place, which is causing the loss of life and totally unnecessarily. I don't think, you know, the UN can't do anything without US approval, but I think the regional powers can. And here countries like South Africa or India and China and Asia have a role to play.
What contribution, if any, did the rationale that Clinton offered for intervening in Bosnia, what did that do to the lubrication of the argument for preemptive strikes of the Bush sort?
Well, if you read Philip Bobbitt's book, Philip Bobbitt, who's a supporter of both Clinton and Bush, takes a great deal of pride in defending the argument that the U.S. had the right to intervene preemptively wherever it wanted. And he says it was he who persuaded Clinton to go into Bosnia. Well, leaving that aside, and the narcissism aside, there's no doubt that that intervention marked a turning point in imperial policy. The choice which they made was an interesting one. The fact of the matter is that the horrible war crimes were being committed by the Croats and the Serbs in Bosnia and against each other. In terms of lives lost, there was nothing compared to what was going on in Rwanda at the time, where a million people were killed in that, which in a situation which was a genuine genocide, actually. The Rwanda is the only situation which I would describe as a genocide over the last 25 years, if one is using that language. They didn't intervene there because Albright and Clinton said, our strategic interests. They didn't quite put it like that, though actually when Clinton explained the Bosnian intervention to a bemused American public, I remember him using a phrase saying we're going in there because it's important for our economy, which is of course total rubbish, but he had to justify it in terms of self-interest.
There was a vulgar Marxist explanation of, again, oil or a coal mine or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly, which I didn't believe at all. I think the strategists in the U.S. administration looked at the Balkans, said the Europeans have made a mess, they've broken up this country, there's a civil war, and here is a big opportunity to go and assert ourselves right in the heart of Europe at a critical time of transition with the collapse of the Soviet Union, with nothing else left. And if we don't do it, the Germans might get too uppity. Don't forget that the breakup of Yugoslavia was not a U.S. initiative. It was an initiative taken by the German Foreign Office. And Oscar Lafontaine, a central leader of the German social democracy, said as much in public. We are the ones who made the choice and to break Croatia off from the Yugoslav Federation. And I've always argued that if they wanted to stop the disintegration of Yugoslavia, all the EU needed to do was to offer $1 billion to the Federation as a whole and said, pay all your staff, keep your army together, maintain a loose confederation, stop repression in Kosovo, or else there will be trouble. And I'm prepared to bet all the leaders of the republics would have agreed. They were completely out of cash. So nationalism arose to defend each narrow ethnic and national interests. And the mess allowed the United States to go in. They've built one of their largest military bases in Tuzla, in Bosnia, which, according to reports, has nuclear weapons, and they've built their largest helicopter base in Kosovo and expanded NATO eastwards. So strategically, from the point of view of the United States, that was a tremendous triumph, the intervention in Bosnia.
Yeah, they're about to buy an old base in Romania, I just read today. Now, let's turn to the big festering wound in the world today, Iraq. We're now hearing that the Bush administration is preparing large offenses for the time after the election. They're sort of rehearsing them now in smaller scale and pronouncing them a great success, at least in what I'm reading in the New York Times. What do you make, first of all, of these claims of success and then the strategy for the months after the election?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the Bush administration has decided on a war of attrition. And this means bombing all the resistance strongholds. And this means a colonial operation on a mega scale. If you looked at the pictures, which I don't know whether they were shown on the screens here, probably not, but the pictures shown by Al Jazeera and Arab television networks, even state networks in the rest of the Arab world, of the results of the bombing in Samarra. Mothers fleeing, crying with children in their arms, houses lying demolished. That really did bring back memories of Vietnamese villages being destroyed during that particular war. If they escalate the war, which is what they're planning to do, I mean, they might score a few immediate triumphs, but in the medium term, the resistance will win massive new support. And people at the moment who are still passive will say, we want arms, we want guns to fight. The model which I argue in Bush in Babylon, which they decided on, a mixture of Gaza and Guantanamo, would sort of receive total vindication if they completely decided to go and destroy Fallujah, Samarra, and even bomb some of the cities in the south if the Shias don't play ball. Now, that's a very dangerous option for them to do, because for a start, all this talk about we're really going to liberate the people and Saddam Hussein was a killer, when you have killed more people than him, that argument doesn't hold water at all and makes it very difficult for your advocates to put forward any notion of this being a humanitarian intervention. It becomes a complete colonial war, and it'll go on for ages. Now, the big problem confronting the United States is this. If they hang on in there indefinitely, I'm convinced they will be humiliated. I don't think they can be defeated militarily. There's no power on earth that can do it. But military defeats on their own are very rare. Even Vietnam was a military political defeat because people at home had said that this war can't go on anymore, and they realized that. If they decide to stay on another 5 years, I cannot imagine that the U.S. public will buy it. The casualties will be too high. They will have to reintroduce the draft. So it's a very dangerous plan that they've decided on. And the Israelis, of course, when they go and bomb places, they're indiscriminate deliberately. Otherwise, they have certain targets, which are disgusting, but they target people. The United States bombs wildly, firing from the hip. And already, anger in Iraq has grown because of the bombings which have taken place in Fallujah and Samarra. And if these were just dry runs for the real thing after the election, I think they will face problems which they haven't even thought about.
Can you make any sense of Kerry's position on Iraq right now, or have any sense of what he would do in office were he to win on November 2nd?
Well, I think Kerry was late in coming out against the war. he waited too long. He's now saying it was the wrong war at the wrong time, which is, of course, correct. He is also saying that they were lied to, which is also correct. That he said he voted for it because of the weapons of mass destruction. I don't buy that argument because the Israelis are the only power there which have it, and they've been left untouched by successive U.S. Governments. But nonetheless, the commission report that there are no weapons of mass destruction have given people a chance to come out and say the president lied, which he did, and Blair lied. It's also playing badly for Blair in Britain. But what you have to follow up then is to say this was the wrong war at the wrong time, and if I am elected, my first priority will be to organize a rapid but orderly withdrawal from that country and leave the Iraqi people to determine their own future. You have to say that. Otherwise, you fall into the trap of carrying on a Republican war when you're in office. And if Kerry wins, which I certainly hope he does, and that Bush is defeated, I think that the anti-war movement should wake up again, because it's partially gone to sleep. It should wake up again and make Kerry's inauguration the largest anti-war gathering the United States has ever seen. In other words, to put pressure on Kerry from day one, saying we voted you in and we want our boys and girls back home.
But could any American president ever be seen withdrawing under conditions of what looks like a defeat?
Well, it depends on how it's played. If Kerry makes a strong argument, if that's the way he wants to go, and says, look, this was a wrong war fought on a total false premise in defiance of international law, it's an illegal war, crimes are being committed, torture has been committed on the Iraqi people, and our choice is to withdraw in 5 years' time in much worse conditions or to pull the troops out now. And, you know, he could go further and say if we had withdrawn from Vietnam in 66 or 67, fewer Americans and fewer Vietnamese would have been killed. This is the time to withdraw.
Now, you've said on this show, among other places, when it attracted some attention, actually, that you think it's important that Bush lose, which in practice means that Kerry win. And whenever people say things like that, you hear, he's no better, maybe worse even, than Bush. How do you sort that out?
I know. The last time I gave that interview to you on the show, I got a lot of rude emails, especially from the United States, but from nowhere else. I got very good emails from Venezuela, saying we saw that interview of yours with Henwood and it's very good you said that. And elsewhere in the world, this is what I constantly say when I'm in this country to people on the left. Look, you have a responsibility to the rest of the world as well. This is no time to fool around. Look at it for once. Do not mimic the imperial rulers of your country and think exclusively about yourselves and your own interests, whatever these may be, or however we define them. But just look at the situation globally and ask yourselves this. Would a defeat for George W. Bush, how would this defeat be seen in the world? And on this, Doug, I am 100% confident that from the Atlantic to the Urals, through Latin America, in Africa, in the Arab, this defeat would be seen as a victory. Now, the response to that comes, yeah, but Kerry would do the same thing, but that's not the point. The point is Bush decided on this war. Bush took the country to war. The neocons and their supporters devised arguments which basically were based on lies, which they haven't been able to deliver, that this was a war of liberation. It's been a complete and total disaster. Should Bush be punished for going to war or not? If you say yes, then you have to punish him. And the best way to punish him is to remove him from office. Then you come to Kerry. As I said, pressure should be put on Kerry from day one. And if he carries on the war, then attack him. But the position will be clear. We removed Bush because he went to war. If you carry on with the war, you could be removed as well. You won't serve a second term either. No incumbent will, as long as you carry on behaving in this fashion. I honestly can't see any argument against this. And people who say, but we're not going to vote for Kerry. Are you advocating a vote for Kerry, you sellout? But, you know, my response to that is, are you seriously advocating that Bush should stay in power? Because that's the alternative. There's no third party. There's not even a Eugene Debs of the Socialist Party winning a million votes and being locked up for 10 years as a result. He's not the round. Nader, quite honestly, I mean, is a joke figure at the present time. I mean, the narcissism is just astounding when you hear him speak. There's no understanding of tactics on a national scale. It's a tactical question, but it's an important tactical question whether or not Bush should be defeated. I mean, to say he shouldn't be defeated, in my opinion, is to underestimate the loss of Iraqi lives and the loss of American lives in this particular conflict. And everywhere I've been speaking and will speak in this country, I am advocating very clearly that in the states, in New York, you can do what you want. In the Bay Area, you can do what you want. You know, it's not a problem. But if you live in Ohio, if you live in Pennsylvania, if you live in New Mexico, if you live in Wisconsin, you have to vote against Bush, which means behaving politically and maturely and voting in Kerry. There is no other solution at the present time.
Now, there's a rather, I think, baroque anti-imperialist argument that Bush, by acting so stupidly and aggressively, is actually undermining American power in the long run, and that Kerry would actually promote it by healing some of the wounds that the empire has suffered. What do you think of that?
Well, this is the argument I never like, because I've heard it too many times before, that the worse it is for the world, the better it is for the left. And it's not an argument I buy. Whether Kerry would succeed in healing the wounds of the empire if he behaved in the same way is an open question. I don't think anything's going to persuade the Germans and the French to send in troops. They can see what's going on in Iraq and they think, thank bloody God we didn't get involved in this mess. So no one's going to support that. I don't think it's going to be easy for Kerry to do that. If he does, he will be opposed. But, I mean, I just find the notion a bit absurd that because Bush is much worse, it's better for us. For me, it's a very sectarian way of thinking, Doug, you know. And quite honestly, no one in Latin America or the Middle East understands that. People are waiting absolutely desperately for Bush to be defeated. And for good reason, that psychologically and politically, that would be a triumph for the anti-war movement, regardless of where Kerry stands.